Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name is Michelle Byrne and I'm here with our guest, Jamie Murphy, who is the interim General Secretary of the Independent Workers Union. So slightly different structure this week. We're going to zoom into the work of the union and some of the campaigns that they're working on, particularly at the moment for their members, and to introduce obviously the work of the IWU and what they're about is Jamie. So Jamie, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great. And for those who are not familiar with the Independent Workers Union, can you give it a bit of a background for people who haven't guessed already? The headquarters is based in Cork, and I'm sure your accent might give that away a little bit. So I'm loving the Munster representation we have on the podcast today. But can you tell us a little bit more about the Independent Workers Union, the IWU?
Yeah, of course. So the Independent Workers Union is, on paper at least, quite a young union. We were formed in 2002. So while we're only about 21, 22 years old, we actually have a really long and quite rich history. So there was a trade union set up in 1916 called the Cork Operative Butchers Society, obviously based down in Cork. And obviously the sector that it represented was butchers. And that was quite a large and quite a strong union in Cork. And when the Trade Union Act of 1946 was brought in, when trade unions had to register for negotiating licenses, COBS, or the Butcher Society, managed to acquire one. And that is the license that the IWU uses today, still. So while the Butcher Society has gone through various mergers and amalgamations, the license has always been retained. And that's the license, like I said, that we use today. And of course, the Butcher Society still exists today as the Cork Butchers branch, one of the sectors of the IWU. I suppose it's important to note that, you know, in our name, Independent, just to explain that a small bit, we are not affiliated with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, or ICTU for short. And that's a vision that's been upheld by our members since the union's inception. And there are many reasons for that, and each member would obviously have their own reasons. But I suppose the primary reason is that the members, when they first set up the union, they envisaged a union that can dictate its own rules and that can dictate how it negotiates with employers, and that there is no arbitrary third party lingering above them to tell them what they can and can't do with their own negotiating license.
That's a really interesting insight. I guess, like, just to kind of explain for listeners, like, the negotiation licenses are quite hard to get, so it makes sense, I guess, that that negotiation license was carry over, and then the IWU has that negotiation license. And with that's obviously then, because it's not a new license and it's not one of the newer, it's very, very difficult to get a negotiation license. So I can understand why that process is followed.
Yeah. So just to maybe give a small bit of an education on this, negotiating licenses, if you were to try and apply for one today, there's two main criteria that you have to follow. Both of which are, in my opinion, I think they're quite hard to nigh on impossible. The first is that you have to lodge a deposit with the High Court, and that deposit is €100,000, right? And the second criteria is that you have to have at least, I think, my numbers might be wrong here, I think it's 1,000 members or 2,000 members. I think it's 1,000 members. But you have to have that amount of member retention for 2 years at least. So you effectively have to create a trade union that does not have a negotiating license, which, by the way, means that you cannot negotiate with employers, that you cannot enter into discussions with the Workplace Relations Commission. And you have to have these members on file, essentially not being able to help them at all for 2 years in order to apply for a negotiating license. And if you apply, that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll get one. So they are exceedingly rare, and that is why it is of vital importance that we hang on to our role. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's been a very long time since there's been a new negotiation license issued at any point. So you mentioned obviously the connection to the butchers workers there and the membership that you have there. Can you explain what the rest of your membership looks like? Are you in particular sectors and where are you organising?
Yeah, of course. So we have six main branches anyway across the country, right? And generally they are, that's called Cork General Branch. There's the Cork Butchers Branch. There is, we have a Cork Home Helps branch. So, you know, Home Helps workers who go to elderly people's homes and take care of them. This is a sector that our main representative for this, she's a titan in the field and she's really, really good at what she does. But it's a sector that's being slowly eroded away by the HSE and privatised out to companies. So that's a really important sector. We have a Dublin General Branch. We have a Northern General Branch, and then we have a relatively new ESB branch. So back in around 2017, 2018, there were a large number of ESB member or ESB workers, specifically their network technicians, who became increasingly dissatisfied with the unions that they were in. So specifically in the ESB, there is what's known as the group of unions. So it's three main unions of SIPTU, Connect and Unite. And these workers just grew dissatisfied with their unions. And what they did was they decided to come over en masse and join us because they noticed that, well, the fact that we're not in ICTU helped quite a lot because I'll go into that in a small bit of detail. If a trade union is in the Congress of Trade Unions, and if a large number of workers from one union wants to join another union in ICTU and they want to leave the current union that they're in, it is effectively up to the discretion of ICTU and the union in which the workers are leaving, if the workers are even allowed to do that. So, for example, if I was in SIPTU and I wanted to leave SIPTU and go to Unite, and I was with a large migration of workers, say 100 or 200, ICTU has the power to veto that. And basically say, no, you're not going. You have to stay with SIPTU. But anyway, so the ESB workers, they saw great potential in that. And they've come over in 2018 and we're doing quite a lot of work with them now. And then I suppose it's not a specific branch at the moment, but we do have quite a lot of Polish and Romanian workers in the union because we have two brilliant representatives who deal with those workers. So again, while it's not a branch, many of those workers would fall into the butcher's branch because it would be a lot of hard work in kind of meat processing sectors and factories normally down in West Cork. Actually, there'd be a lot of Polish and Romanian workers there. So they're the main sectors, and then of course we just have general workers who can come to us on the day to day asking for advice or asking for us to help them negotiate or whatever. So we are a general workers union, but we do specialize in certain sectors. Yeah,
that's great to hear that you've such a deep membership with the migrant workers and the meat plants as well. And you mentioned as well that you've quite a young membership, and I know listeners won't be able to tell, but Jamie, you're quite young yourself, and I'd probably argue you might be the youngest interim or general secretary in Ireland at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, so for full disclosure, I'm 28, although I don't look it, I look a bit younger. And our membership, it's really refreshing, right? A big reason why I was drawn to the union about 5 or 6 years ago now is because when I entered, the first thing that I noticed was how, for lack of a better term, hungry for new blood, the former general secretary was Noel Murphy, who your listeners probably have heard of at some point. He's been around for a long time.
He also spoke on he was on our podcast our live podcast that we did in UCC where we talked about the Dunn's workers campaign as well. He was talking to us then. So if listeners want to listen back to that, they can hear about Noel Murphy.
That's a good plug. Yeah. So he was hungry for young blood, right? Young members. And so was the executive committee and still is. And when I was elected to the executive committee back in 2019, I was expecting, to be quite honest, a bit of backlash, not because there was anybody on the executive committee that would be opposed to me being on it, but that, you know, who's this young whippersnapper who's 25, 26? What does he know about workplace relations? Has he ever worked a day in his life? That kind of carry on, you know. But that wasn't the case. It was the complete opposite. It was any ideas that I had were welcomed and explored. And it's not just me. There are many, many young members now who have joined since and continue to join, who have fleshed out the Dublin branch, who have fleshed out the Cork General branch and the Northern branch, and who are also on the executive committee and who effectively help run the union on the day to day, which is brilliant to see. Yeah.
I think that's really refreshing to hear as well, because I know many other unions will be talking about, you know, strategies to attract young members and, you know, how do we get, you know, a lot of our unions are on the aging on the side of things because, you know, the density just isn't there amongst young members, or the turnover is quite high. And, you know, lots of the times it's linked back to the precarious nature of the work. Like, you're trying to unionize a workplace and suddenly you're in a different workplace, or, you know, people are leaving. It's much, a lot more transient kind of work. But I guess, like, what kind of, like, how did you see young people being attracted into the IWU?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I used to work in a call centre called Abtran, based in Cork. I think they have an office in Dublin. And to be quite blunt, it was harsh shit work, right? While it wasn't physically demanding, it was mentally quite taxing. And it was many people of the same age as me, a lot of young people who worked there. And this was before I got properly active in the union, but I still was part of the union. And I saw this as an opportunity to try and unionize this workplace. And the immediate reaction that I got from all of my younger colleagues was that they didn't know what a trade union was, right? The older members or the older workforce there knew what a union was. And they had this kind of hesitant mentality born, I think, from the 80s and 90s of, like, a union doesn't do anything for you. They're just there to collect your dues, right? And the younger workforce didn't even have that mentality. They didn't know what a union was. So going to workplaces, I'm using this as an example because it's still the case today when I go into workplaces, when other of my union colleagues go into workplaces, young people don't know what unions are. So the first task is to actually just explain that and explain why a union is vital to increasing your terms and conditions of employment, your pay, and everything else to do with your work. So I think while, you know, unions are finding it difficult to attract young people into them, I think it's because, not that young people might be anti-union, although of course that is a possibility. It's that most young people just don't know what a union is. And I think that's where we first have to enter into some education. And any kind of propaganda that we put out should maybe just explain what a union is first before saying why we are so great, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, there is that piece, and, you know, it's not something that our curriculum is going to actively inform people about, yeah, you know, before they leave school. Like, I know, you know, there is the politics class been introduced in some places, and there's like one sentence in like the business class where they like say this is what a trade union is, learn this definition, but don't, you know. I remember my brother at one point said, you know, someone was saying that the question was asked in an exam, what are the pros and cons of being in a trade union, was like on the exam paper, and it's like
what were the cons?
Suspicious framing of a question in a business module. But yeah, that's really, really interesting. And so that kind of education piece is really important, and how we get that out. And even though it's one-to-one conversations, like, that's kind of where it needs to be started from, is like, actually, this is what trade union is. And we can't expect people to know exactly what the function of that is just because the word has been bandied around a lot. And as you say, like, propaganda is there to say, like, this is what trade unions did for us, or like using those old examples as well of like, you know, we've got the weekends, we've got the 8-hour days, but, you know, really, what, how do we see ourselves in those discuss like those historical moments, to those struggles, without actually kind of explaining like how it got there in the first place. So I think that's really interesting. But obviously the IWW are doing some great work at the moment. You have like some great live campaigns that I've been following on social media and chatting to some of your members about. One of them would be the most recent one, I think, is with the Iceland retail workers, if I'm correct on that. So can you tell us a little bit about what the union is doing there with their members?
Yeah, of course. So Iceland, for those who don't know, is a brand of supermarket, and it's all across the country. And recently, the brand Iceland, in Ireland anyway, and I think it's the same with the UK, but in Ireland, it has been acquired by this company called Home Savers. And that this transfer of undertakings happened at the end of February of this year. And what a transfer of undertakings basically means is when one company's executive board gets dissolved and another bigger company comes in and just takes it over entirely. And all current staff and stock and all that have to legally transfer over. So all the Iceland staff who have been working in their places of employment, some of them upwards of 10 years and above, they all have transferred over to this new management. Now, the Iceland stores still exist, but from my understanding, I think Home Savers are trying to slowly get rid of them and rebrand them into a Home Savers outlet. But what has happened since this takeover back at the end of February is that workers would normally be paid weekly. They would normally get their payslips on a Thursday and then get their money into their bank account on the Friday. But what's ended up happening is that since this takeover, workers have not been paid correctly. And this has kind of manifested in various forms. Some workers just haven't been paid at all. Some of them have been emergency taxed, even though they've been working there for years. Some of them just haven't gotten payslips. Or there are some workers who are part of the union now who are out on sick. And while they would still get their sick pay every week, they're not getting it, or they're getting incorrect hours. Everyone's case is different. But to put it in a broad perspective, their payroll just isn't doing the job, basically. So this was their main concern at the start, that they were not getting paid correctly. And also, just before the takeover happened, some of the workers were promised voluntary redundancy if they wanted it, which some of the workers wanted to take. And then when this new management came in, that deal was not honored. So the people who were expecting their voluntary redundancy have not gotten it. So that was their main issue at the start. And what I did was, myself and some colleagues, we went into these shops, we spoke to the staff, and what we found was that it wasn't just the, you know, for lack of a better term, rank and file workers who were getting mistreated. It was also store managers, right, who were getting not paid correctly, who were not getting paid annual leave if they had it coming, etc. So it was full shops who are feeling this pinch, which created quite a rare occurrence where when we went into the shops, it wasn't us trying to talk to workers out of earshot of managers. It was full shops sitting down with us, explaining that, look, we're getting fucked over here and we don't know what's going on. And what they tried to do in the interim, informally, was to get onto payroll, get onto the new management and ask what was happening. And they effectively got no response. And if they did get a response, it would be a week or two after the fact. And this lack of pay kept happening for weeks, right? And in all this time, I was writing to the company asking them, look, what's going on? These people need to be paid. And I received no correspondence back. And to date, by the way, I've received nothing back from them. Now, while that was bad enough for obvious reasons, right? At the start of April, the air conditioning in all the shops, specifically in Dublin now, in the Dublin region, I'm not sure about in other counties, but in the Dublin region, the air conditioning was turned off, right? And the workers there informed us that air conditioning can't be turned on locally at the shop. It's done remotely. So even though store managers had keys to get into whatever part of the building they wanted to, they could not turn on the air conditioning. And we had our workers there measure temperature. And in some cases, it got up to and exceeded 35 degrees Celsius, right? So basically, if anybody had any kind of underlying health condition or was pregnant or anything, they were at serious physical risk of damaging their health.
And interesting enough, that's something that we would have covered, that temperature thing on a previous pod, like how in Ireland we don't have an upper range for, you know, what's the highest temperature in the workplace that you can like down tools and walk off. But obviously then you're encouraged to go to the health and safety authority and raise the issue in that way. But in other countries, they would actually have a minimum maximum temperature that you can work in. But we don't have that, obviously. And obviously, who is ever controlling the remote for the temperature knows this.
Yeah, it's just to touch on that a small bit. The legislation is really vague because it effectively says that around 17, 18 degrees Celsius would be the minimum. And it just says an unreasonable temperature exceeding, or it doesn't even say exceeding, an unreasonably high temperature is not on in a workplace. And there's a lot of debate as to what unreasonable might entail. So what we ended up doing was, obviously, again, it's worth bearing in mind that any complaint that we had received by our workers, we were actively contacting the store constantly, every time, to try and get these issues fixed, right? Because we understand how important, you know, negotiations and correspondence are. But again, to reiterate, there was never any correspondence back. So what I did then was I made a complaint to the Health and Safety Authority about this. And I'll go into that in a bit of detail because I didn't know, again, to be blunt, how useless they were until I engaged in the process here. So when you ring the Health and Safety Authority to make a complaint, I honestly assumed that I wouldn't be allowed to make the complaint as a trade union representative. I thought that the workers would have to do it themselves. Luckily, the person I was speaking to was quite nice, I suppose. He listened and he understood that the issue was awful and that it needed urgent attention. Right. So I submitted the complaint and I asked him what happens next. And he basically told me that the company will be contacted, and if the company does not respond within 7 days, then there will be some form of investigation launched. But, and this is the kicker, if they do respond, and if they deny the allegations that I've made, there's nothing that the Health and Safety Authority can do. So basically, how this looks is, there are workers working in 35 degree heat, right? And I don't know if you've ever worked in heat like that, but it's extremely unpleasant. You have workers working in this heat. You have a complaint then submitted to the Health and Safety Authority about this, right? Which I think is unreasonably high temperature to be working in. And then the shop, all they have to do is just deny what I've said or deny what any of the workers have said. And that's it. They wash their hands of it. So,
and I assume they did actually respond to the HSA despite not responding to yourself.
I still, to this day, don't know. And the reason why, and I have contacted the Health and Safety Authority a few times after this, asking for an update. And of course, the response I get is, we can't give you any update because this is an ongoing matter. And I said, all right, look, fair enough. What about when it's concluded? Will you at least let me know how it went? And they said, no. They said, once the complaint is filed, that's it. So I said, all right. So we can only assume that the management have written back, denying the allegations, and because we've heard nothing about it since. And we have heard reports now, though, in some shops that the air conditioning has been turned back on. So maybe it did spook them. But it's not good enough, right? It is not good enough for the Health and Safety Authority of the country to not have the force that it should have to make sure that workers are not working in potentially lethal conditions.
And even as a complainant, getting that feedback back to know if it's been dealt with, you know, in order for people to have, you know, faith in the institution of the HSA to be doing their work on that. And you mentioned before as well, that you are also involved at the WRC with the Iceland workers.
Yeah. Yeah, so when, again, just to go through it in a bit of detail, when a worker normally has an issue with their employer, right? As a trade union, what you normally do at the start is you try and engage with the employer to try and fix the issue first. But if that doesn't work, and a lot of the times it doesn't, but a lot of the times it does, but when that doesn't work, there is an institution that you can refer a complaint to, and it's called the Workplace Relations Commission. And when you submit a complaint to the WRC, you submit it under a specific act. So, for example, with the Iceland workers, they weren't getting paid. So the act that you submit the complaint under is called the Payment to Wages Act 1990. And your complaint is really straightforward. It's that I have not been paid for X amount of days. Can an adjudicator help sort this? And what happens is the employer is notified, and then, the worker and the employer have to sit down with a third party, the adjudicator, and the adjudicator then decides if what has happened is lawful or unlawful. And if it's found that the person, the worker, was not paid, it's unlawful, then the adjudicator awards the worker what they're owed, right? Now, while this process on paper sounds quite good, in practice, this process can take months, if not years, to get rectified. So even if a worker has not been paid, as with our Iceland workers now, right? Some of them are down a couple of grand at this stage with like back pay that hasn't been paid to them, emergency tax that's not been given back to them. The list goes on. So we have workers who are down a couple of grand who need this money to survive and are relying on the goodwill of the employer to pay them, right? So we have put in complaints for all of our members under the Payment of Wages Act and under a few other acts as well that we believe that Iceland have broken here. But the problem is our members are not going to get this money until these issues are resolved because the employer is refusing to deal with us. Now, a lot of the time when a WRC complaint is lodged against an employer realizes that it's easier to just solve the issue before it gets to in front of an adjudicator, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's the case that someone has not been paid and we contact an employer or we put through a complaint, the employer normally gets onto their solicitor and their solicitor tells them, look, cop on, pay them. And then it's put to bed, right?
Yeah.
But our workers here now, our members, they could be waiting for 6 or 7 months before they get any justice. So that is why we need proactive action in these shops as opposed to just sitting back and being passive.
Yeah. And I guess like you've used the institutions now that are there, you know, to try and resolve this. So I guess when you mean you're not going to be passive any longer, what do you mean by that? Have you decided to escalate in the actions and with the members decided?
Yeah. So it was the members who approached us, of course, who wanted to do what any good set of workforce will do, and that is withdraw their labor. They wanted to go out on strike. And of course, if this was in 1970 or 1980, they would have done that about a month ago. But there's a bit of legislation called the Industrial Relations Act 1990, which basically has put in place criteria to make a strike legal, which of course means two separate things. The first thing is that it can make a strike legal, but that means if these criteria are not followed, strikes are actually illegal, right? Or strikes can be illegal. And the criteria, again, on paper are quite straightforward. It can have the effect of shattering momentum. And the criteria of the act is that workers have to be balloted secretly, and those ballots have to be scrutinized. They have to be kept on file. That's fine. But then the employer has to be informed that the workers are balloting for strike action. And then once strike action is approved, the employer has to be informed at least 7 days before the strike is going to take place, which effectively means that the power of a strike, the power of being able to drop your tools and walk out of a shop, can be severely lessened if the employer has any cop on and gets cover in for the day.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, if workers just walk out of a shop, they can shut the shop down for the whole day, seriously hit the employer's profits. But if the employer knows it's coming, they can put steps in place to try and hinder that.
Yeah.
But even though this is what we have, we're still working within it. And our members in these Iceland shops have been balloting. So far, the shops that have been balloted have all approved strike action. Well, industrial action up to and including strike action. And yesterday, the National Executive Committee of the union had a meeting and sanctioned strike action as well, if the members want to take it. So that is what I mean by being active. The workers here still might, some of the shops might still be working in this exceeding temperature. All of the workers still haven't been paid properly. Mm. Some of them have been getting their pay slips correctly now and have been getting paid for the weeks that they've worked over the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks. But they're still owed, like I said, some of them up to €2,000. So rather than waiting, and while the WRC cases will still go on, we can do this in tandem, in parallel.
Absolutely. And I
think keep the pressure on. It's the most powerful tool we have. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, important to keep the pressure on, especially when people are waiting for money that they're owed. You know, like that could make a huge difference to someone's lives and whether they can put food on the table or not if they were, you know, if they had planned to have that in their pocket. But yeah, I think that that's fair play to the workers and send solidarity to the Iceland workers as they build on the next steps and escalate. It's great to see and be one to watch, and be interesting to see if any of the mainstream media pick up on it as well, which is always a bit of a difficult one.
So there's, and I suppose the final thing that we need to do now to really help the Iceland workers go out and not be afraid to withdraw their labour, to go out on strike, because it is a scary thing, right? You know, when you go on strike, you are effectively forfeiting your day's pay, which is why we're currently setting up a strike fund for these workers. And I don't have the full details yet of how we're going to get that set up, but keep an eye on our socials, because we'll be spreading that around everywhere. And hopefully by the time this podcast goes live, I might be able to have a link to give you to post in the description or something. I just encourage anyone listening, if you have a spare couple of bob, throw it their way, because they're already down money and they'll be down even more money just to show their employer that they mean business.
Well, absolutely, and thanks for plugging that, Jamie. That's important.
Yep.
And obviously that's the Icelandic workers now. They're like, the Iceland workers, they're coming to a crunch point now, and they're not Icelandic. Iceland workers are coming to a crunch point now with their industrial dispute. But I guess they're not the only members as well who are gearing up in the union. I know you mentioned to me around the home tutors members that you have, and you know, the potential bogus self-employment that they're facing with the Department of Education.
Yeah, so just to give a bit of background to what home tuition is. So there are regular primary and secondary school teachers, and then there are special needs assistants. And home tutors are kind of a blend of both, where home tutors are teachers, they're qualified teachers, who are engaged by parents of children with special needs, or children who are still trying to find a placement in school, or who can't go to school for various different reasons. So home tutors go to these children's homes and they engage them in a one-to-one setting. And they basically teach them the curriculum of whatever class or year they're in. So this can be primary school students up to secondary school students. But the home tutors are paid by the Department of Education. It's on their pay slip, right? So they're paid directly by them. But they are not classed as employees by the Department of Education. So what's happened here is they are in a case of situation of limbo, right? Where they are not getting any of the benefits of being self-employed, because if you're self-employed, you get to set your own hours, you set your own rate of pay, and you set your own days of work, and you set your own hours of work. So you can effectively dictate whatever your work practices are. But if you're employed, obviously there is what's known in the legislation as a master-servant relationship. So there is someone who tells you what to do, right? You have a boss, and your boss tells you that you go to X place, you work there for a certain amount of time, you're only allowed to work a certain amount of hours a week, you're only allowed to get paid X amount of euro an hour, the list goes on. But What comes with being employed is that you have annual leave and that you have sick pay and that you have various other protections. For example, being covered under the Unfair Dismissals Act if there's no more work there for you, being covered under the Redundancy Payments Act if you need to be made redundant. You get all of these protections if you're employed. So these home tutors have neither of these benefits. So we entered into negotiations with the Department of Education. I tried to anyway, to try and see what the situation was, right? Because from all arguments that I can see, these home tutors are employed, right? Just to give a small bit of background as well, the home tutors I'm dealing with at the moment are based in Cork, but from my understanding, this affects all home tutors across the country. So these home tutors, from what I can see, they're quite clearly employed, right? Because if you are getting paid by someone, if you get a payslip, it's quite clear that you're employed, right? Now, that's obviously not the only argument that you can make. But if someone is telling you how many hours you can work, where you can work, how much you get paid, it's quite clear that you are an employee, right? But the Department of Education have not acknowledged that. So it's been 2 years now. I lodged a complaint to the WRC about this. And a first round of hearing was heard back in March. And I can't go into the details of it yet because it's not concluded. But their argument is effectively that the department is not trying to say that the home tutors are self-employed. They're just trying to say that they're not the employer. They're trying to wash all hands of it, right? They're trying to say that they're the facilitator of payment, and that's it. That's where their relationship ends. But it's important to bear in mind that, like, the relationship does not end there, because these home tutors are qualified teachers. So, like, they are vetted by the Teaching Council, which is embedded in the Department of Education. They are teachers themselves in other schools. So they are embedded in the Department of Education. It's being made out that, like, they're these drifters who kind of come in, do this work, and then get paid, when that is really not the case. So I suppose the reason why I'm highlighting this specific issue is that it's yet another case of bogus self-employment, what makes it particularly egregious is that it's a government body doing it. It's a state body engaging in this malpractice.
Yeah. So absolutely, absolutely. Like it is, and like perhaps they think they can get away with it because of the institutions that they've set up, such as the WRC, maybe not being exactly functioning in the way for workers that it should be too. You know, like you're saying there that you're waiting 2 years on that particular case. And that's 2 years of work for those home tutors where they haven't had sick pay, where they haven't had annual leave, where they haven't had all of those other employment benefits, not self-employment, but employment benefits that come alongside having those kind of contracts. So, you know, that is the WRC not working for workers as far as I'm concerned, because if you're not dealing with the issues in a quickly and timely manner as they arise, then people are still struggling through the issues that they've had for the last 2 years and probably beyond, like further on from that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's just to park the home tutor situation for a moment and just to address the WRC, it really is a situation of, if you know, workers who have complaints come into me all the time, and come in, they approach the union and they ask for help. And the answer is never satisfying because, again, right, using the Iceland workers as an example, if you're not getting paid properly, if you, let's say, have not been given a contract of employment, which you're legally entitled to after a month of working, if you were dismissed unfairly after working somewhere for 10 years, right, you want, as a worker, an immediate solution, especially if it comes to pay, right? But the institution that has been set up is not immediate. It has been, I suppose, corrupted in a small way by the legal system, where it just expects that you just work on and that you get over it and that, look, eventually the law will work. Eventually you'll get that pay. But that's not going to fill your belly, like, if you're down paying your paycheck. You don't want an eventuality. You want an immediate solution. So when workers come into me and I have to tell them, look, legally you can get this, there's no problem. you're just going to have to wait a year potentially. It's yeah. It's completely dejecting. And what's more, and I don't want to sound too depressing, what's more is that if you have a pay claim, right? Let's say 1 week you're not getting paid properly. You're down 100 euro in your paycheck. You put in a complaint to the WRC. Next week, if you also don't get paid properly, you have to put in another complaint, technically. And that has been used by employer solicitors to void and invalidate claims for that. And what's more is that these pieces of legislation have a retroactive application where you can only go back 6 months, which basically means, right, you put in a pay claim for 100 euro, you're not paid for another few weeks, so that pay claim goes up to maybe a grand. But you don't put in any other fresh complaints. A year goes by and the complaint is heard. A smart solicitor then would say, hang on, you only put in the complaint when you weren't paid that 100 euro. The adjudicator, if they have to abide by law, says, okay, you're only owed 100 euro. And because 6 months has passed, you can't claim that other 900 euro, which is pathetic. And it's, why I'm not trying to sound depressing. I'm trying to almost do the opposite. I'm trying to make you angry.
Well, there's obviously a lot of things that are stacked up against workers, but I guess when workers are stacked up against employers, that's when it's more important, you know, when we're all up against together against the union, having that inside knowledge within unions to be able to support how those claims and how to approach those claims so that, you know, can't be used against them or whatever. But yeah, I think the big thing is that when, you know, that's why unions are so important. Like, these are very real examples of how we can make, you know, progress in these areas, particularly, you know, where it's probably very hard to find representation. I'm sure like the home tutors are working in individual homes, you know, so it might be very hard to have like conversations with colleagues or people in the same place as you're all bogus self-employed. There might not even be a network there. I'm not even sure, but you know, it's an example. It's a great example of how maybe a very disconnected workforce have come together to unionize in this issue, which is great.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because originally how it happened was one home tutor approached me and we got the ball rolling. And then a separate home tutor approached me. And then I was like, well, do you know each other? And it turns out that they did. So then we started branching out. And of course, that they're all qualified teachers. So they know other teachers who also maybe do home tuition. So this kind of network starts spreading. So yeah, the one constant, the thing that bound them together, was the union. And that is what has been driving them forward.
Great. Great to hear those examples. And another area campaign I know that I've seen that your work on is around the security workers that you represent as well. And maybe there's another example of like workers who are kind of on very lots of different sites. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that, but can you tell us a little bit about the security workers campaign as well?
Yeah, so I wouldn't be the most knowledgeable about it now because the majority of the work is being done up in Dublin. And there's a brilliant team up there with the Dublin branch who have been really kind of grasping onto it. But from what I know anyway, their basic agenda is to try and create a specific security workers branch of the Independent Workers Union to focus on their issues specifically, because we have quite a lot of security workers now in the union. So it makes sense that that sector would get their own branch. And what their main issues are at the moment is, obviously it always comes down to pay and terms and conditions of employment, but specifically because they're security workers, as I'm sure you know, that security workers work awful hours. So a lot of them would work during the day, but many would work during the night, work really unsociable hours. And they would not be paid fairly for this. So there's a bit of legislation called the Organization of Working Time Act, which allows for a premium to be paid if you work on a Sunday or if you work unsociable hours. And unsociable hours are between the hours of 12 and I think 6 or 7 in the morning. And a lot of security workers work these shifts. But what ends up happening, and it's not just security worker, or it's not just security companies that do this, it's a lot of employers, unfortunately, is that they say that your Sunday premium or your unsociable hours premium are incorporated into your hourly wage. So when you're working on a Sunday, you don't actually see the benefit of working that Sunday. So, for example, if you were to normally, the industry standard would be get time and a half or double time on a Sunday. That's been eroded down now through union density falling to maybe 1.2 times, maybe an extra 50 cent an hour, something like that. But rather than seeing that on your payslip on the Sunday, it's just tacked in small bits over the course of your payslip for the entire week. And it's a way of employers getting around acknowledging the fact that they are giving you a premium for working on a Sunday. It's a concerted effort to make sure that workers don't know the rights that they have. Right? But bringing this back to the security workers then, because a lot of them work night shifts and a lot of them work Sundays, they're seeing a similar trend happen with their wages, where they're being paid a premium technically, but it's a pathetic premium, where when you work night shift, you should be paid time and a half or double time, right? In some industries, it would even be triple time, because you're effectively forfeiting your entire day to do this job, you know? So that is a huge issue that is being campaigned on. And what's happening at the moment is that the security workers are putting together a manifesto of claims that they have towards their collective bosses that they are working on launching at some point in the future. I think sometime soon, but I don't have the exact details on it. But all of these details will be laid out in that manifesto, and that will be posted on the socials hugely, obviously, and it will be presented to the employers. And hopefully by that time, we will have a security workers branch as well that will have its own committee that will be able to be front-facing too.
Great. That sounds really, really interesting. There's a lot going on there in the union across very different workforces, which is brilliant. And as you say, like those workers might not necessarily be connected unless they had the union. I think it's been really interesting to hear some of the details of those. And obviously, if anyone here is listening and are in any of those industries, I'm sure they'd be very interested to talk to you more about that, to get onto the union, the Independent Workers Union. So I just want to say, I'm just going to wrap it up here, because we've had, like, that was such a great conversation. Thanks so much for all of the details, Jamie. It really gave us a great insight to the union and the work that the members are doing. And I just want to say a big thank you. So this has been a special of the Week at Work. So thank you to Jamie as our guest, and I've been Michelle. And as always, please share out this pod, send it to people you might know in the sector of some of those workplaces that we've mentioned today. The Week at Work is obviously part of Left Block, a political education and media project, and you can find out more information about it on patreon.com/leftblock.